Welcome to another episode of Zero Ambitions, a podcast about sustainability and the built environment. This week's guest is Kate Crawford. She's someone who's been on our radar for ages, as you'll hear in the episode. She's a building nerd who's obsessed with measuring performance, and she is currently technical director at KLH Sustainability, a multidisciplinary consultancy working within the built environment. I mean, you probably guessed that. Anyway. Kate has an interesting background in terms of her experience, and she's working on a very interesting project that is researching and developing a smart meter-enabled thermal energy rating system, SMETA. The SMETA system uses a different approach to measuring building performance and a different kind of metric for assessing it. The result is something they call the snug factor, which is the heat transfer coefficient of the building. I mean, Kate explains all of that. It's not simple or necessarily that easy to understand, certainly for me, but the way they have generated their heat transfer coefficient has led to some incredibly accurate estimations for energy use in a home. So with that degree of accuracy, as she describes it, it means they're working with something that has an awful lot of potential baked into it. Aside from that, like, she's got this really interesting array of experience from working in consultancies, from the army, from working in disaster zones, which is particularly interesting, the number of parallels, which, well, you'll hear us talk about. Yeah, there's loads. She was great. Two things before we get into it. It's just me and Jeff. Shout out to Richard Jack at BTS. He is a future guest who will be joining us, who's, as it turns out, part of the same program. Or involved in the same thing. And just one last thing, you'll hear Kate refer to a negawatt hour quite frequently. That's a measurement for energy that's not used. Nega, like negative, watt. She says this, but I just wanted to overemphasize it at the start in case anyone misses it when she says it, because if you're walking about or doing something, it's easily missed. Anyway, right, I'll let you listen to it. Cheers.
Yeah, we're good. There we go.
So do you two know each other? I think that's a yes.
Yeah. We did. We had a chat actually about
too,
a similar topic. Yeah, with Zach. And I was banging on about some of these questions.
Oh, cool. Yeah. Which Zach?
Zach from Energy Sprung. Oh, he's not.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
I think Alex, our colleague Alex, is on the call as well. It sounded like you were doing fascinating work. No.
When was that? Was that ages ago? Was that for the podcast?
Oh, like a year, I'd say more.
Yeah, you know? More than a year. Yeah. And it was at a point when I couldn't really talk about anything publicly. Yeah. And so I was sort of being, I had to be like a bit cagey, even though I was like passionate about it.
Yeah.
Well, what fabulous timing then, or serendipity or whatever. I've heard your name a bunch of times. People have said you'd need to talk to since they had the conversation with you. I can't remember who exactly. But
no, I'd love to know. Yeah.
We would have mentioned it at the time as well. But I think, yeah, there was that issue of you having to be a bit cloak and dagger, I suppose, or
exactly.
Whatever the right.
Well, yeah, I've been racking my brains. So it could be Kate Simpson.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I mean, I only know her on the internet. I really follow what she's doing, so yeah.
She's great. I think of her because she's put so many names in front of me. You need to talk to these people, are doing interesting stuff. If I ever work it out, I promise I will let you know.
That's great. Yeah.
But we had a chat the other week, Jeff, and man, we've got fucking loads to talk about, I think. So did you get a chance to look at the notes, Jeff?
No, I've just running, you know, from one thing to the next, and I'm
that's all right.
It's always the way, but particularly now, I mean, I can't even contemplate how busy I am.
So we're going to talk about background, origin story, Jeff. Okay, it's time. Starting out consultancy, ditching consultancy, working through crises, like actual crises places, from Indonesia to Lambeth or Southwark. Is it Lambeth or Southwark?
It was Southwark, actually.
Anyway, and then we'll talk about SMETA. We'll get into SMETA as quickly as we can.
SMETA. Yeah, brilliant.
That's where I think your passions lie at the minute. And Jeff, being the consummate building nerd, it is right up his street.
Brill.
Yeah, welcome, Kate. Yeah, welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for joining us.
Well, thanks for the invite. I was literally swooning with surprise when I got the invite because it is one of my favorite things to listen to, and I keep sharing it to my whole team. Like, you must listen to this one. So, yeah, delighted and surprised.
Thank you very much. We've had quite a run of guests flattering us recently. We can't rest on our laurels, of course, but it's nice to hear. It's lovely. Thank you. Well, we've heard excellent things about you, to be entirely fair, hence reaching out and asking you if you fancy joining us. So, you, Kate, are a building nerd who's obsessed currently with measuring performance.
Yes, that's right. I'm currently working as technical director at KLH Sustainability, and we are very small but perfectly formed kind of multidisciplinary sustainability consultancy. So we're a cross-cutting sustainability consultancy, I should say. So we look at operational energy, circularity, embodied carbon, and fighting the data gaps with all of that stuff. But prior to that, I worked for Knauf Energy, and Knauf Energy was a participant in the UK's smart meter-enabled thermal energy rating competition. And I think it's come back now because we're working with Knauf to look at how the outcomes of that can fit into what's happening with the Future Home Standard, home energy model, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a big circle. Or actually, it's just a wiggly mess of things in my career all connecting together. But yeah, I'm obsessed with SMETA for like reasons that are not all technical. And I'm obsessed with what we can know by measuring performance and what that might mean for shifting systemically, really, the market for how we make housing better.
Just one question. Should your colleagues in KLH be worried by you saying that you're currently working for KLH? It reminded me of that old joke of somebody talking about their current wife.
Yeah, my starter marriage. Yeah.
You've got to get up the marriage ladder, don't you? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, Knauf is currently one of our clients, and they've come to KLH because I'm at KLH. But the trouble is, I'm obsessed with lots of things. So I love to have like a varied portfolio of things. And KLH is perfect for that because there are a whole host of questions to answer, and actually a really surprising variety of different types of client who come to us. So I'm quite lucky that I get to do my geeky deep dive passion on monitoring, and I get some perspective on some of the other things that are changing, and also the team is quite special.
I love the text on the KLH homepage. It's kind of a bit aspirational, but it's kind of counterintuitive with this. We are sustainability advisors working towards a flourishing world where our services are no longer required. So trying to do yourself out of a job. I mean, good luck with them. You know, we're kind of careering towards apocalypse. So I think you'll be all right for a while, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. we can come on to talk about apocalypse.
Yeah, yeah.
That's another topic of mine. Well,
we definitely have a catastrophe plot point in there, don't we? Oh, Jesus. Right. So you got to this point through, was it your own consultancy?
No, I started way back in 2001 with a consultancy that's now part of Mott MacDonald called Fulcrum Consulting. And for those that know it, it was a very, more than I could even appreciate at the time, it was a very forward-looking environmental consultancy set up by a number of just brilliant people who fused kind of growing up in a family of builders with studying biology. But it was amazing. And Brian Mark, who was one of the guys that interviewed me, we had a job interview in September 2001. And I'd mentioned that I'd been somewhere where they had a composting toilet, and he literally reached across the table, squeezed my arm. And I knew, because he was so excited that I knew about composting toilet, I knew it was the place for me. And my manager there, Ashley Bateson, is now at Hawley. Lots of people know him. Susie Diamond, who is one of my great colleagues there, set up Inkling. Fantastic. And then James Hepburn at BDP, he was also from Fulcrum. So these sort of people who came with this slightly more mission-oriented engineering back then are now in other places doing other things. But it was a really interesting time and an interesting political time, and interesting things were being built all over the place in the UK. So that's how I started.
When you say mission-oriented approach, what do you mean?
I just mean, I think people came because they had an interest in the role of engineering in the environment. So I trained as a civil structural engineer. That was my degree. And I'd done a sort of summer placement at a structural design company. And I was literally designing columns for glass boxes on Greenbelt land. And I was like, this is not where it's going to change. I can't believe I thought this at this time. I was very immature, but this was my like revelation after being a little bit bored over one summer. And I was like, oh, maybe it's building services where things are going to really change, because that's all about operational energy. And so that's what we had in common. So a lot of the people who were at Fulcrum, well, it was one thing was amazing mixture. So we had people who had been on site and had been plumbers and then had retrained. And then we also had, well, plumbers and builders who'd retrained. And then we also had building physicists and really traditional M&E engineers fusing together with these sort of like people who wanted low impact living, you know. So it was quite a nice melting pot.
Rare, heady mix. Yeah.
It was. Yeah. It was. And I still look back fondly on that time, because I didn't realize, I thought it was great, but I didn't realize how great until I sort of re-entered the world of consulting and realized how many things have changed, but you still find these pockets of 2001. The other 2001 that I didn't live.
The thought of all of those people working in that particular manner, like it, with that sort of structured thinking, I'm thinking back to 2 years subsequent to that when Jeff and I are scratching around trying to start the magazine.
No, it was 2001 we started it. We started the business. It was September 2002. We started the business. We were working for a terrible magazine in September 2001.
Yeah.
Terrible, terrible magazine.
And if anyone's interested in that origin story, there's an episode from January last year. Yeah. But I don't remember encountering anyone doing work as sort of coherently or holistically as that. I mean, and that will be potentially down to our investigative skills at that point in time.
It would have been pretty rare, I think. I mean, it still is to this day. I mean, this idea of, it's just so important if you can have people from different disciplines engaging and informing each other's work. That kind of collaboration and dialogue is absolutely essential. Like, you have a designer building or designing a detail that, as soon as it hits sight and touches reality, it's just unbuildable, you know? So that kind of stuff is so often missing. So I'm presuming that you were able to kind of address some of those kinds of issues through the different kind of approaches and knowledge that were brought to the table.
Definitely. And I got many drawings back with slammed down on my desk with like, that is not going to work. it was special. And I feel like the tentacles have reached far and wide. So Susie Diamond just won the small consultancy of the year with Sibsy, and like her consultancy is really small. And she told me she got a message from Brian all the way from Wales saying like, well done. So I think, well, I don't know how everyone else feels about it, but, and maybe I'm just being sort of sentimental in my old age, but I think it was a really interesting moment. We worked with like Urban Splash in Manchester. We worked with Bioregional, and they were just interesting clients who were asking like good questions and trying to be ambitious in as much as they could at the time. I mean, lots of the things we were proposing then are the same things we're proposing now. Lots of things then weren't always taken up, and now there's an impetus to take up some of these things as standard. But yeah, it was a good time.
Yeah. Are any things you were proposing back then that you'd look back on now thinking, oh God, that was crazy. Why do we think that? Any things that, you know, that you wouldn't do?
Yeah, that's a good one. I think so we were proposing MVHR and Ashley, my manager at the time, had spent a lot of time in Sweden and seen a lot of their building. But funnily enough, a lot of the stuff, even now, I don't know if I'm skeptical, but a lot of the stuff with water. So we were looking at low water use. We were looking at grey water recycling. We were looking at kind of black water on-site treatment and package treatment. And even now, I just feel like there aren't enough case studies that I make me feel confident that those are viable things to suggest. And then it was even more outlandish, right? Because it would have been so unfamiliar for users and they didn't want to see kind of grey water in toilet bowls and so on. Still, that is a thing mm-hmm. now. And some of the guidance as well, I look at the codes and guidance and I think, gosh, it's really unadventurous, but it's also, this is really geeky, but one of the things we would try to design out is like dead legs in hot water pipe work. And that's just not anywhere, as far as I can see, in terms of a standard. I might be wrong and I might have missed it, but the water guidance and the energy guidance, and it is in Passive House, by the way, but you can design a completely compliant building in terms of water consumption without that being a consideration. That's not a way to reduce water consumption in the way that you measure the water efficiency of a building in the regs.
Yeah.
And I think that's really niche, but I'm just surprised because we would bang on about it. And I always, whenever I'm somewhere and I turn the hot tap on and it just runs cold for ages and I think, oh, waste.
I know. It's fascinating. I have to dig it out. I got a link to a report, some new research recently, which indicated that some water conservation measures in the context, I think, of hot water usage, I have to be careful. It may have been low flow fixtures and things, were found to be increasing energy usage. And I ran this by my wife and she said, well, yeah, I mean, if you've ever tried washing your hair with a low flow, it takes a lot longer to wash your hair. So there can be, you know, I wouldn't like to reach a firm conclusion. I think, and that's another probably episode in its own right. But until these things actually, you know, you run them by people, actual users, and you find out what the actual data shows, it's kind of hypothesis, really, you know?
But this is something we've found from doing this project with EnergySprong, where we've been interviewing residents who've been through a deep retrofit. Just the weird things that you encounter around the usability of a building and how people are impacted. Like the key recommendation, or one of the key recommendations that we've made, which didn't have a home in like the main framework of the document's feedback, but the report's feedback, was in the briefing process, when you're going through a brief with a resident for something like a deep retrofit, walk through the house with them, acting out a week of their life. Like literally do it side by side. You could do it in a couple of hours. What do you do Monday? What do you do Tuesday? Everything from their morning routine, so you can account for things like, oh, so what happens when you wash your hair? Like something, who has the first shower? How many people have to have a shower? Does it happen every day? Like all of these things can be accounted for in a way that you can plan for the current users of the building and long term. And all the way through to an instance where because of the positioning of the house on a weird, busy main road, the residents they didn't have a peephole in the door. So they used to look from the living room window just out and to the left, as it was, to see who was at the front door. But when the external wall insulation was added to the building, the depth of the EWI meant that they couldn't see to the front door, which meant they couldn't see who was there in order to let people in. So then the new front door had to be replaced for one with a peephole, but it was replaced with one that had the peephole positioned too high for anyone to be able to see through it, any of the occupants, because they were all too short. So they'd have to be dragging a chair to the front door or keep a stepladder there. Like all these little things, like, man, you just walk through once. Like you will see all of this stuff. You're even likely to capture like how people, the idea that they need a peephole because they won't, oh, man. And like you can build this cumulative experience and feed that back into program design, housing design, retrofit design, all sorts of kinds of design. It's a mad thing.
I love it. I think because you kind of say, but who knew? But then you would have known if you had, if you'd asked, but not even asked. Like,
but that's it.
Need, you know.
Yeah. When you can't know how to ask, like you just wouldn't occur to you to think. But if you learn how we aren't capable of theorizing, hypothesizing how people live their lives, you've just got to watch them and then take that, feed it into the next phase. I mean, we've sort of stolen this from healthcare, from patient support programs, because where it is a codified part of the practice. But because we don't care about people in buildings and how they use them, why would you bother asking people what they want or need or whatever?
And you also, you know so little about, it's like when you grow up and you don't realize the weirdness of your family until you start to return with your like 20-year-old peers back to your family home, and you start to realize like some of the things that are different. And I think it's that sort of thing when you, if someone asks you about how you live, you don't think of mentioning the things that are things that are totally normal. Like,
yeah, by the time you get to your 40s, you've experienced enough of other people's families to know that in spite of their wild idiosyncrasies, thematically, they're all consistent in ways that change the way you expect, you consider people and behavior. And yeah. Right. Where, how did we get onto that?
I found, by the way, I was going to include a reference because I found it. Professor Ian Walker was the academic who did this research. And the study, what they found was that in the university, that water pressure was a determining factor. So showers with, there was a clear negative relationship between water pressure and consumption. More powerful showers used less water overall.
Wow.
That's interesting. I'll include a link to it. Yeah.
But yeah, that makes so much sense. But yeah, that'll be in the show notes then. Oh yeah, we were talking about just things in relation to design from your experience at Fulcrum.
Yeah.
How do we get from there to disaster zones?
Oh yeah, so, well, by this weird moment where I was supposed, having done, by the way, that slightly boring structural placement, I went back and I was supposed to be doing my master's project on the subsidence of Bury St. Edmunds Cathedral, but the project fell through and I got put in a different project doing testing of cold climate shelter with a whole group of people who were looking at shelter after disasters for cold climates. At that moment, it was Kosovo, and the guy that supervised me had just come back from Kosovo, and they'd had this whole winter program called One Warm Room. And because I was in touch with them, I went off to work for Fulcrum, and I carried on doing some like experiments, live outdoor experiments on some of these shelters with that team of researchers. And then at the end of 2005, I think it was, which was the year that followed the tsunami in the Indian Ocean and a massive famine in Niger and another crisis, the Pakistan earthquake happened. And I got a call because so many people had been like deployed to the limit of what they could do. Mm-hmm. And Oxfam said, are you available? And so I went to Pakistan. I think they took a bit of a gamble on me a bit, but they were really interested in the fact I'd been in the military for a year before university, because I think they thought, oh well, she'll be sort of all right if she catches camping when she gets there. And anyway, that's how it kicked off, and I was only there for a couple of months, but it was like right after the earthquake happened and right in the middle of Ramadan as well. And from there, I then worked in a number of different disasters, usually deploying as sort of an emergency person who would go in like early for a short period to do assessments and set programs up, and it would cover like water and sanitation and also shelter after disasters, which is often initially a tented structure and then evolves, or it can be a toolkit as well. So that's what I ended up doing back and forth. I was able to do that because I was doing a PhD at UCL at the time, and so I had some ability to go back and forth. But then the last thing I did was in 2013 on the border, on the Turkish side of the Syrian border, and that was with Save the Children. That was the last thing I did, and I just couldn't do anything more after that. But the main thing that triggered a lot of the experiences that hopefully I can tangentially I can return back to Smita, but the main thing that really changed my view of everything that I knew was working after the Haiti earthquake in 2010. And that was like a massive, large-scale destruction of like urban areas. And I think I always say that it was the experience of the aid industry, not the experience of Haiti, that was disturbing. And I emphasize that all the time. But I think there are a number of things around like the mass destruction problem, the inability of aid agencies to tackle the bit of they were really ready to tackle the bit of the problem, which was, this is a completely destroyed building. Once the rubble's gone, we've got a solution for this, which is a lightweight timber frame shelter. And that is not a bad response if you can do it quickly and if you can do it cheaply and you get people undercover, you get them protected, you reinitiate their livelihoods, because lots of people's livelihoods, especially in some of the hillsides in the Haitian capital, are home-based. So it's not per se a terrible thing to do, but all the money went to that, more or less. Almost nothing went to the problem of what about the buildings that were partially destroyed? And there's no, that was too hard. It's like a mass customization issue. There's like a perception of risk that you're bringing from like Californian earthquake engineers and Japanese earthquake engineers and Italian earthquake engineers that is coming from a different framing. Mm-hmm. And so I felt really strongly afterwards that we'd had this view of the problem that was like one engineer per building approach to safety, when it was much more about a whole population and a whole population of buildings, and thinking about safety and risk in that context is much more like public health than engineering. And it started to make me think a lot more about data and what data would have meant if we'd known like the sort of tenure of buildings and where they were, and if you had to prepare again for such an event, it might be useful to know the type of building and the type of tenure and what was at risk, and put those, the social things, together with the structural things. So yeah, a lot of things came out of it. I think in terms of like changing my mind, one of my good colleagues called it bringing heart surgery when hand washing was needed. He's a structural engineer at Bureau Hapwood now, but that pretty much sums it up. And there still, by the way, there isn't an answer to this that I think people are happy with. But the other part of it is, and this is what I said to Jeff when we had a chat last week, is this is something, I'm just going to read you something I wrote about.
Yeah.
This afterwards, which now I feel a bit ashamed of writing, but I said, I often wonder whether our experience after disasters, that's us, you know, the privileged outsiders that sweep in, gives us both a glimpse into the future and a special insight into our profession, because we work with these sort of, it's like sci-fi, the juxtapositions between like this epic apocalyptic destruction followed by rolling out of things like retinal scanning for allowing you to access humanitarian food supplies and things, you know, things like that that happen very fast at a scale and sophistication beyond anything that we're doing to ourselves in the UK. And the thing is, the thing that I regret is that I was saying that I could glimpse this future, this kind of apocalyptic future, but that is lived now and it's not the future.
I mean, it's one has to go through these experiences in order to achieve, I don't know, enlightenment enough to recognize. I mean, this is what folk mean by check your privilege. It's not like you have to feel bad for being a white person. It's just recognize yourself, recognize your perspective and your biases. Like, I think that's been one of the curious things that came out following the Sue Rolfe episode that we did about managing thermal comfort, where because she's a white middle-class lady, people perceive her as having white middle-class lady experience first and foremost. And the way she speaks is as a white middle-class lady. But the perspective that she is offering is one of the global South, rather than just a lady who grew up in Oxfordshire or Bedfordshire or wherever she's from. I can't remember specifically where. Like, it's not a home county's perspective. Like, for all one might criticize her for her beefs with Passive House, like, fair play, like, what she is forewarning us of, by and large, is the way temperature is going to change and the way we're seriously going to have to rethink how we manage it. So that chimes really strongly with what you're describing of like getting a glimpse of one's future. Because like, she's seen it, folk don't like to hear it. And folk, in fact, find it hard to appreciate quite what she's saying because of what is projected upon her. Like, it rings very true.
Yeah, I think she's, I agree with Sue in lots of areas. Where I probably differ is in some of the prescribed solutions, I suppose, in some cases.
You know? Yeah. And you love Wolfgang Feist, and she is less keen on him.
Well, I mean, you know, I'm not a fanboy. I mean, I've had perfectly personable engagement with Herr Feist, and that's fine. And I think the passive standard is a good solution in a landscape where many attempts at notionally low energy building don't work very well. But you know, you cannot be evangelical about it. Everything has its limitations, you know.
I think it's worth
you have to poke through them and try and understand what they are and understand where it's appropriate and where it's not and so on, you know. Yeah.
I think it's worth like offering a bit of context though for this, because like Jeff is saying this from his bedroom where you can see the posters on the back wall of Wolfgang Feist, Paul McGrath, Mick McCarthy, Jack Charlton. Like that's what we can see. Daniel O'Donnell, or is it O'Connell? Which one is it you prefer, Jeff? I can't remember.
The singer or the Republican.
Yeah, and God bless us all, the Queen.
What I want to really, actually, one thing I do want to approach, we had this fascinating long email diatribe between myself and Sue over biomass burning, and I am not in favor of that in general. You know, the setting things on fire to keep warm in a place where you spend 80%+ of your time doesn't seem like a terribly clever thing to me. I know there's good technologies to improve it, but one person I want to have on the podcast is Dr. Ben Jones from the University of Nottingham, who's done this amazing research recently on a harm sort of index, looking at pollutants of concern based on how prevalent they are in the home and how harmful they are. And the one that comes out by far top, he's got like six top pollutants, and the one by far at the top is PM2.5, which you get from burning biomass and coal and things like that. So anything that either pollutes the indoor air or contributes to polluting the outdoor air and therefore contributes again to polluting the indoor air, I think is ill-advised, would be my perspective. You know,
is that something that comes up in disaster zones? Like air quality?
Yeah, massively. Well, it comes up in the places where disasters have a terrible impact, if that makes sense. But yeah, I don't know if you've heard of Practical Action or ITDG, as they once were, but they've been doing studies on the impact of household, of cooking inside for a long time. It is thought that if people after a disaster are suddenly moving to a habit of having to use a fuel they haven't used before, or they're cooking in a much closer closed environment in cold weather, that it has an effect on acute respiratory infections as well as being really cold. But yeah, the literature on this and what it means, especially for women and girls who tend to be in the home exposed to pollutants, it is massive. Strangely, also the vulnerability, depending on the time of day that an earthquake happens, if you tend to be the person who's in the home at that time of day, you can often get really odd outcomes in terms of women and children being killed and injured because they were indoors. That's not across, you know, every context, but
yeah,
it does make a difference. If you've got a crap building or crap air quality and you're the part of the family that's home, there's consequences.
It's just injustice heaped on injustice, isn't it? It's ridiculous.
Well, I mean, it's like, without wanting to sound trite, it is what you just described is entirely analogous for like some social housing conditions, or in fact not social housing, like private rental conditions, where the homes are totally inadequate to be lived in, worse than the Victorian or industrialized, the caves of industrialization that working class people were housed in. Like, yeah. Because you don't have the ventilation that was created through the open fires to at least clean the homes out a bit. I mean, that was tempered by the broader air pollution everywhere.
But to say, there'll be a fascinating piece of research. I'm sorry, Kate, I'll stop shouting on there. There'll be a fascinating piece of research done in Ireland, I think, in the next... there's some amazing indoor air quality researchers going on, in Ireland. Mary Coggins and McGrath, what's his first name? James McGrath, and Miriam Ryan, and so on. And over the last few years in Ireland, we have essentially eradicated boilers and chimneys as well under our building regulations. It is extremely rare to find. We've electrified heat across the board. If you exclude apartments, heat pumps are nearly 100%, really nearly 100% of new homes. And in apartments, again, there's no combustion devices either. So it would be fascinating to study that, to see what the impacts are on mortality, morbidity, and so on. You know, those people against people with combustion devices.
Yeah. Sorry. Well, I think there's another part of this, and that there's a sort of causality in both directions as well with housing and health, because housing affects your health, but your health affects your housing opportunities as well. And so it's like a known public health phenomenon that it works both ways, which makes it sort of harder to measure and single out, you know, other factors.
Yeah, it's tough. Yeah. So this whole experience, like one of the things you mentioned was the experience demonstrating to you that we need to think more broadly than one home at a time.
Yeah, I think so. I did a lot of hand-wringing after that experience because I was like, was it me? Because I could see these decisions had been made over and over again to prioritize one solution. And I knew that it wasn't an accident that had happened, but I also knew it wasn't like per se a conspiracy because I'd been part of a lot of those decisions. And I was like, is it the way engineers think about this problem, i.e. me? Was it that we kept reporting, you know, how well we were doing at what we said we'd do, but we didn't look again at maybe that wasn't the thing we should keep doing. We didn't check whether our initial assumptions made sense. All the sort of images and stories and maps made us focus away from what people were capable of doing for themselves and, you know, towards their victimhood, which was it's a long-standing problem in humanitarian aid. But when I was able to like step away a little bit from like, was it me? It's all my fault. I have such a big ego. I thought it was all my fault. I pinned it down really to it's about the money going to what is measurable and controllable and what has what we would call a return on investment, but in aid it's not called that, but it is about visibility, delivering something you can show you've delivered by the people who've funded it, and it narrows the scope of what you can do to things that are mm-hmm. quick, don't involve talking a lot to the people who are receiving them, and eventually delivering garden sheds that some of which cost more than it would have cost to rebuild in the style of a Haitian house. And, you know, 2.5 years later, literally that's what happened because we stayed in that groove. And so then I was thinking about what is that return of investment problem with a broken house, not a destroyed house? You know, mm-hmm. what is the threshold when you say this isn't worth repairing? And the other revelation then is, oh shit, it's not a calculation, right? It's a deliberation. Like, this is not something you can calculate because the thresholds of interest are not an engineering threshold. They're a social, political threshold that has to be agreed about what is cost and risk. And that is not what engineers should do because we implement what other people have decided is safe. We don't necessarily or shouldn't necessarily be deciding what the rules of safety are. We should be part of it, but ultimately that's, you know, same with doctors, same with, you know, the National Institute of Clinical Excellence. Like, they, when they set a threshold for like, we're going to spend this much to save a life, that's not based on, there's not like medical evidence for that. It's just, it has to be decided.
Someone had to make a decision somewhere. That's
it. Yeah. A line was set through deliberation. Doesn't mean it's wrong. It just means, you know,
you're diminishing the value engineers have in the process there somewhat. Because
careful, why do you want to, the value that engineers have? Don't say value engineers because that. Yeah.
Don't value engineers. Yeah. Yeah. Also, I should also say, when I talk about engineer, before lots of listeners get wounded, I'm really talking about the old me. So I'm really thinking about how I process problems, and I'm kind of generalizing to a whole, stereotyping a whole group of people and saying that they think in a binary way.
Well, there is something of like the culture of engineering, like the way in which it is structured in terms of its education and deployment, and the way its value is measured. I mean, much like with the rest of the built environment, there are all sorts of problems that are already set up. Like, some of the least listened to but most interesting conversations we've had on the podcast with engineers, like structural engineers. Like, I was mocking Will Arnold the other week for engineering being boring. Structural engineering being boring. He isn't boring as an individual. But the subject seems to not be of a special interest to people. But like, we had...
There's a terrible joke in there as well, by the way. Structural engineering being boring, especially in the case of, like, you know, Highland Foundation. I don't know.
Christ. especially when digging tunnels. Yeah. Oh God. Like, Tara Fraser was really interesting. Like, the lessons that she was able to offer from thinking, using engineering to think about impact. Because as Will Arnold said the other week, like, structural engineering is where you can have your greatest impact. and engineering, because it is like a foundation of the decision-making process, as you described, how people come to be able to make decisions or have decisions made for them for implementation. Man, yeah. Like, there's an awful lot that should be rethought, reconsidered, which I suppose is where we begin to come to with what you're up to now, because the way you described it, measuring performance is something that has plagued you.
Yeah, and also the problem of the threshold where you demolish or you don't. When I was looking at, when I sort of switched my gaze away from seismic retrofit of disasters, I went via this really brilliant initiative called the UCL Engineering Exchange, which was set up by colleagues at UCL to have research funded and commissioned by communities instead of government or industry. I ended up working with Just Space and the London Tenants Federation on a review of some of the decisions that were being pushed for to demolish kind of social housing in London on a technical or environmental basis, usually around operational energy, when that was a sort of veil. It was a sort of technical veil for a whole different reason for demolishing. And it turned out, this is shocking, and I don't think it's still the case. Listeners will correct me if I'm wrong here, but the GLA weren't tracking demolition of housing by tenure. So, or new builds and demolition by tenure. So it looked like it was, you know, balancing out, but it really wasn't. I mean, it's much clearer now, I think, to the wider public that that's what's happened. But I got involved in the public inquiry around the Aylesbury estate demolition, which was one of the kind of really controversial and painful ones in London. Miserable, actually, for people in the local authority in Southwark. The people who've been sort of working with it for many years, they were just a bit destroyed by it, and the leaseholders were destroyed by it as well. So really grim. But because I was thinking, oh yeah, but if think about mapping all of this and having data about whether these buildings are really performing, I got pulled into, as a consultant really, but I got pulled into a small startup that was trying to measure performance of buildings. And that was like the perfect moment, because they wanted to do it at scale. And I was like, I'm obsessed with this problem of scale. And they were wanting to measure the fabric performance. And so I ended up, not just as a consultant, I went to work as the sort of first employee and ended up building a lot of the sensors that we used initially for prototyping. I was like building them in my room and doing things I never thought I would be able to do or could do, and trying to like write code. Man. You know, 10 years ago, there was no ChatGPT to write it for you when you got stuck. So it was sort of amateurish on my part, but I much later met someone from Urbanistas, which is this brilliant built environment group in London, and their motto was start by starting. And this was that. I didn't know how to do it, but I had someone pushing me to do it. And then we formed this really small tight team where we had a sensors person, a machine learning person, a cloud person, and it escalated and we ended up with not me making the sensors, basically. So I think that the thing that happened at the same time, so this moment was also a moment where, you know, iPhones had been around for about 7 years. When I'd done my master's on these cold climate shelters, I'd been in this like minus 20 pet food freezer in Peterborough, and the research equipment I was using with thermocouples and so on to get temperature profiles through this fabric construction would have cost like £10,000 probably. It was really clunky, but that's what it would have cost in like the late 1990s. And because of the new iPhone technologies and phone technologies and computation that had entered the world, these kind of suites of sensors that you can now put around a building just cost a fraction of that. And it's changed everything. But I think the main meeting of hearts and minds really with the people driving this, which was Knauf Insulation, was that they had a sense that the market for installing insulation was quite broken and very low quality in terms of the workmanship. And they also had a vision around wanting lots and lots of buildings to be better insulated. Obviously, they're an insulation company. What they were trying to do actually was not necessarily measure directly they weren't trying to find a number for how well the building performed, actually. They were trying to build what they called a negawatt hour meter, like an energy meter, but for energy savings. And what they wanted was to be able to say that an investment at scale in retrofit had a measurable benefit. And the view was, the reason we are much more likely to invest in a power station to supply energy is because we can measure the output. It's back to return on investment and controllability and measurability. And they were like, if we can measure it for scattered, distributed improvements to homes at scale, then the money to do that will come because we can show it worked. And the funny thing is, I wasn't really allowed to talk to anyone about it, but if you do try to talk to people about it, they don't really realize how much we aren't able to do that. We actually have no idea. They don't realize how crap SAP is or EPCs are in terms of actually housing performance. So they weren't as excited as me. I was like, this is amazing. But they're like, why can't we do that? But the other subtlety of this, and I think this is different from how people think about retrofit, this megawatt hour meter doesn't measure like before and after a retrofit. It measures now with and without a retrofit. So it's like a sort of real time. If you were doing all of these things in the same way on this day, but in your old house, this is the energy saving. Not on the 12th of January last year, your bill was this much, but the 12th of January this year is this much. It's slightly different. And I think that's interesting because there's a reverse causality, just like we talked about with housing and health, where it's not necessarily that when you observe lots of data, it seems like upgrading the energy performance of a house can sometimes increase energy consumption, right? When that's looked at in aggregate, it kind of works the other way as well, that you retrofit because you're about to increase demand. So sometimes you change your home because you're about to have a change that is going to increase demand, like having a baby and knowing you're going to be home all day or retiring. So there are these other moments in life that drive the rise in energy consumption that's driven the retrofit, not the other way around. But this megawatt hour meter measures the before and the with and without difference in a slightly different way. So it's like a different way of thinking about a real saving.
And a way of illustrating it in a way that is immediately meaningful.
Yeah, because when you get your bill, you don't know what you were doing, the weather, or the systems in your house. Like you can't distinguish them in an energy bill. It's impossible.
That's amazing.
So that's what we were trying. That was the mission. And then the SMETA competition arrived, this smart meter enabled thermal energy rating competition, which was quite annoying because we'd gone to Bayes, I think in like 2016, I went with my colleague, Stephen Heath, who's the technical director for Canal Insulation here in the UK. And we'd sort of showed them this. We'd showed them megawatts. And then they launched a competition for like everyone else who hadn't built the technology to do it yet to have a go, which as a citizen of the UK, I love, because it's the right sort of model for, you know, an entrepreneurial state where the government invests in innovation where the private sector hasn't crowded in. I love that. I love that it was a competition because it was a blind test. So that means that everyone who participated in the competition and measured the performance of a house had to submit their results in an envelope. And then each house had also had an experiment, and I'll talk about that, to measure this number. And then they checked if they matched, right? And I love that as well. But with the sort of Canal hat on, it's a bit like, oh, that's annoying. But that's where we are. And actually, we've got, like, now there are other people with these technologies, and that's a better situation also as a citizen. So like Build Test Solutions are also doing this. But what that meant for the technology we were developing, we were interested in megawatt hours. The SMETA competition was interested in what is called a heat transfer coefficient, which is the number you get if you multiply the U value of each element by its area and add it up. And it's in watts per degree. I'll say degree C because it's always given in Kelvin, but who cares about Kelvin? I mean, I love Kelvin, you know, for the physics, but it just makes it more obscure. So then what we were doing is finding this heat transfer coefficient. And I think one of the things about the fact that a heat transfer coefficient is in watts per Kelvin is that it means people think that nobody would possibly ever understand it as a metric. But I'm much more on the side of, imagine when you sold a car, you didn't give miles per gallon. You gave, this will be your petrol cost for a year. That is like completely not useful for anyone. But miles per gallon, you can compare and do something with it in a slightly different way. And that's how I feel about the heat transfer coefficient, or HTC. I think it should be called a snug factor, and it should be like togs when you buy a duvet, because that's what it is. And it also then...
That's fantastic. That's a great concept, yeah.
Well, that's what happens when you're obsessed with these things. This is what you wake up in the night with, having a revelation. And it also like reconciles some of the things. So, well, we can come on to that. I can mention how I think that snug factor fits in the Future Home Standard in a slightly different way from how the Future Home Standard's been approaching this. And I'll just say one, you can cut.
I'll just
say one thing on this, which is that in the consultation on the Future Home Standard, it acknowledges that lots of the standard metrics it was consulting on do not allow for the direct comparison of, this is reading from it, right? They do not allow for the direct comparison of the design intent of their building to the metered bills. Mm-hmm. And they're principally for compliance with the building regulations rather than as information tools, by which they mean informative for someone who lives in a house. And energy performance certificates, on the other hand, are the primary information tool for building users and include an estimate of energy, etc. And, you know, the problem is that they have this dilemma where they can't reconcile that they need a standardized metric, therefore a standardized occupancy, to turn watts per degree C into kilowatt hours per year and energy bill, which also has limited meaning to people on a day-to-day basis. But what I like about the snug factor is it is a reconciliation of those things. It's something you can measure. It's also something that it's a number in all of these models. If you took it and said, this is the rating, it's actually a far more useful rating, a kilowatt or an energy bill in pounds, which doesn't match your energy bill at all and never will, and isn't there to match your energy bill, but is given to you as if it's an energy bill that might align with your energy bill. So I think there's many problems with how EPCs are calculated, but there's also a really massive problem with how they're presented, which is that they have probably the best part of the calculation is the heat transfer coefficient, and then the rest standardizes it into an energy and then a pound numbers indicator. And then it's given to people in pounds and all the information is lost because pounds they recognize.
Yeah, yeah.
But also pounds are mismatched. So it's just...
So you're taking some intensely nerdy, boring to normal people data and turning it into a meaningful indicator, like something that could be intuitive, like with enough time and enough experience, could be intuitively meaningful if it was used with consistency.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and I'm thinking back to years ago, this is going back to 2009, I think it was, I lobbied the last Green Party coalition government in Ireland to include this mad idea I'd heard about from Vermont called pay as you save, to pay for energy upgrades through utility bills. And the UK Green Building Council was involved in lobbying for something similar, same kind of concept. It ended up getting into the program for government, although because of concerns about copyright infringement, they called it save as you pay, which is very backwards. But when we were lobbying for that and doing our research, I got talking to a couple of the big utilities, and there was a guy, oh God, what was his name? Gus Geraghty, who worked at ESB, the big kind of formerly state monopoly electricity supplier in Ireland. And after the Iran oil crisis in 1979, he paid for, I think they teamed up with Moy, what became Isover Insulation, and insulated about 30,000 attics on people's electricity bills. And then after that, in the 80s, they developed this whole kind of consumer-facing brand to sell appliances, energy-efficient appliances and so on, and insulation and so on. The research they had from the 80s was that comfort is the main motivator for people above energy. Comfort was number one. Environment was way down the list back then. And now, of course, these things change, but it was just a fascinating insight. And I just think I always kind of do an eye roll when I hear people talk about payback, you know, as if that's the only metric that you can look at. Thinking about these other benefits and trying to frame it in those ways could be much more meaningful for a lot of people, I think, you know. So I'm all for your kind of TOG rating for buildings type approach. It sounds fantastic. Yeah.
Do you want to, I don't know if you want to talk about this, but we could talk a bit about how the technology works and what it does.
Yeah. Yeah. That'd be really useful. Yeah. Like, getting a sense of like how it works.
Yeah, and I.
It's magic. It's just magic, isn't it?
It's magical. Yeah, it's magical. So, quick journey back in time into how this has been done in the past. The gold standard, and it still is the gold standard, is what is called a co-heating test. I think it doesn't need to be called co anymore, but one of the reasons why they were called co-heating tests is because this test is to heat up a building and see what happens. And in the past, because people were very aware that there are lots of things that happen that are really hard to handle with the maths, like changes over time, the mass of the building and solar radiation and how that affects what's happening. If you heat up two similar buildings at the same time that are in the same environmental conditions, at least that simplifies some of the environmental conditions because they're both experiencing the same thing and you can kind of eliminate them from your inquiries and focus on comparing the building you know to the building you're testing and trying to infer data about. It's probably a terrible explanation of the co-heating test, but the whole point is you heat up a building and you measure the temperature difference inside and outside the building and you plot that on a scatter graph as it changes and you plot the power you had to inject into the building to get that temperature difference on the scatter graph. So it's in two dimensions, you get a scatter plot and of course the temperature difference between inside and outside is higher when you've pumped more power in and it's lower when you pump less power in. And you basically, everyone's done it at school, you draw a best fit line on that scatter and it's a regression. To do it so that you get a reliable result is much more sophisticated. You have to take into account more dimensions, particularly the effect of sun. But what you don't have to take into account is people. So you can totally eliminate people from your inquiries and focus on the fabric of the building, the infrastructure. And that is what had traditionally been done. And in SMETA, that was done on the houses that were tested. So each participant had their SMETA, their meter, that could do this, and they put it in the house, and those houses had already had one of these co-heating tests when no one was there. Now there are people there, and they run a monitoring over a winter period. Co-heating needs about 3 weeks. It depends, but let's say you need a house that's empty for 2 to 3 weeks, but monitoring, you could have the winter season, so less controlled, but longer period. And the reason why not just the sort of paradigm is different here is partly because we can get more data over a longer period at a lower cost. We can handle that data more cheaply and faster because of cheaper computation. And amazingly, the toolkits for doing this data analysis are free. A lot of the machine learning and statistical toolkits to do this analysis are libraries of code that you don't have to buy. And that's because people have spent like geeky time since the 1970s making stuff like this available. And that's kind of a wonder in itself. So the paradigm's shifted from my engineering paradigm, which was very low on statistics and based in a 2D sketch where you find a best fit line. You can make it a 3D sketch, which you can still draw by hand and visualize and imagine, and you're finding a best fit surface. When you're monitoring a building and you're collecting lots of different data, mainly, I mean, it's really just temperature and humidity data and conditions outside, you have many, many more variables and it's a bumpy surface where you're trying to find a best fit. So that might be a terrible explanation of regression, but a lot of this is just linear algebra, but it's on steroids and you can operate it in a way that just wasn't possible for a sort of regular person. So you need data and you need a statistician and you need coding. So it's a different toolkit from I'm going to run a really controlled experiment and put a measuring kit in there and analyze it. So I've labored that a little bit, but it's partly because we just hit a lot of strange barriers to accepting that we'd nailed it. So just to say, I say we, right? But obviously I don't work for Knauf anymore. But the Knauf results for that SMETA competition are buried in an appendix for lots of reasons to do with how the project was funded and how the IP was negotiated, which were just messy. But they're buried in an appendix, but they are like completely nailing it in terms of the error bar. And the funny thing is that nobody asked us. Nobody was like, wow, you must be like doing something really different here for this to be so good. And I think the best question, and actually the most frequently asked question we got, is like, yeah, but what if people open windows you know, in, and we're like, ah, that is the old paradigm. Like, this needs a different way of thinking about it. And the way it works is, because we'd started the journey in the space of the negawatt hour, we didn't care about finding the snug factor of the house. We cared about finding the drivers of energy consumption that were due to the fabric of the house. And guess what? If the anyone who was in that SMETA competition, if they had reversed their model, if they'd flipped their model and used the snug factor, the heat transfer coefficient that they'd found and submitted to the competition, and then used it to try and to estimate the energy consumption that they also had measured during the competition, because these were houses where the smart meters, SMETA, were being monitored and they had that monitored data. If they'd flipped it around and said, can our approach to this accurately predict the real time, real energy use of real people in this real house, then they would be getting to flipping their model around and not trying to find the heat transfer coefficient as an objective, but trying to predict the energy. And then guess what? You can only predict the energy if you know the heat transfer coefficient very accurately. And so that's how it works. And we've written that down to tell people that's how it works. Like, so there shouldn't be any surprises. But the other beauty of that is that the barrier, I guess, that the SMETA participants and the kind of government face now is like, how do you roll this technology out? Because if our way of assessing whether it's right or not is based on co-heating tests, we can't keep doing co-heating tests on loads and loads of houses, because we'd have to keep people out for 3 weeks to measure it first and then test if the SMETA is working. Or we can use the same houses that we used for the competition and get other people with similar technology to go and use those houses, and those houses we have known results for, but it's limited, right? Because not all the houses are like those houses. So the way that we...
I wanted to ask that actually, in terms of the actual houses themselves, what characteristics did they have and how many were there?
There were around 30, and they were social housing houses owned by the same provider. A condition was that they would have gas-fired central heating. And the whole concept, I have to say again, like the whole structure of that SMETA competition is brilliant, and we need more of those things for all sorts of innovation. But the argument I'm making is that another way of confirming whether the SMETA is right or not is to say, okay, you've got this instrument called the SMETA, which is made up of some sensors and some data processing and algorithms that arrives at an answer. What if we give you data for January and March, but nothing on energy consumption for February? Can you use what your machine learning algorithm learned in January and March to predict energy consumption blind for the whole of February? And that's doable. So we, Knauf, did that with, I think, Fraunhofer. Anyway, they've published it. But the other thing I love about this is, if I live in a house, I cannot run my own co-heating test. But if I live in a house, I can say to the person who's offering me a SMETA, I'm going to switch off and deny you my energy data for a month. You tell me what you estimate, and I'll be able to see whether you've estimated it correctly, and therefore the HTC, the snug factor for my house, is a reliable snug factor, because you can only get an accurate prediction if you have an accurate snug factor. And there's a lot of other clever ways that you can test that it's not just fake or based on just one slice of data. If you slice that data up, you can try and learn the house from different slices of data and see if you get the same result as well. So that's it. It's not, it took us a really long time. I mean, this was like 6 years of trying to do this. But I think we're now at a moment where this technology is potentially going to be integrated into parts of the eco funding, into building code and the Future Home Standard, as another way of verifying, along with modeling in a slightly more sophisticated way with the HEM. And so it is a real moment to think about what this means, because the conversation so far has been a really geeky conversation between people who are the BEIS Technical Advisory Committee, who largely sit in universities and do co-heating research, and a moment where, like, there could be a systemic change that could drive money and drive quality in a way that hasn't been possible before. It like all technology, this is not a silver bullet, because actually doing retrofit well, as we know from running a lot of the projects that were monitored by Knauf, it's really hard. It's really hard to do it so that people are okay. It's really hard to do it so that the details are right and the house is well designed for now and for the future. there's a lot more to this than just measuring. But the flip side of this is measuring can change systemically some of the other things that make retrofit slow and hard and under-resourced as it has been. I think, yeah, go ahead. Sorry, I was rambling on.
No. So it's not like you're going to have a SMETA in every single instance, but you've got something that's really good for validating, really good for predicting, really good for building a body of meaningful data in a reliable manner that can be used to inform everything that happens subsequently. Like in terms of something that the construction industry doesn't like having its homework marked, but you've got an accurate way of marking it, and you can transpose that into a meaningful indicative mark for ordinary people, not just high performance building nerds. I mean, that feels quite significant.
Exactly. Like you can know if the work made a difference. You can't fix it if it doesn't. Like you, if it does, if the work hasn't made a difference, you've had an expensive infrastructure change. But it can, you can have a pain gain contract, right? Where you say, okay, I've got 300 houses, but you, contracting team, need to demonstrate that this has worked. And if you can't, there's a contractual obligation to like fix it, rectify it, lift your game. And it doesn't mean all the details will be good, but maybe they'll be a bit better.
Well, one would imagine that was already a part of contracts within the built environment. If you're talking
it's starting to be. The Scottish Futures Trust have been doing this recently. Outcomes based funding sort of system.
Yeah. How is it just now? What is the year? It's 2024, and we're only just caring about, or we only just care enough to put it in as a contractual obligation now.
Yeah.
Like, fuck off.
I know.
No, it's not so much people kind of the band playing on as the Titanic sinks. It's more kind of engineers trying to work out how to design a better boat on the Titanic as it sinks.
Yeah. The Social Housing Decarbonisation Fund had like performance outcomes. So did the Retrofit Accelerator GLA. You know, those big procurement contracts had performance monitoring, right? But this performance monitoring is neutral to the household. It is monitoring the infrastructure change achieved. And because I hate talking about behavior, that is good for me because it's the infrastructure change that, and that's hard to do if you're just measuring energy consumption.
Yeah.
Well, you mean you can't blame poor people anymore? Is that what you're trying to say?
Yeah. It's moldy because of lifestyle, which is one of my favorite.
Lifestyle
choices is a great word for the right as well, isn't it? Yeah.
Oh god.
But this is why I hate it, right? Like behavior, and it's not because I don't care about building buildings that work for people. It's because I passionately do care. But so when you go into people's houses on a regular basis to do this kind of monitoring, and you actually meet them, and then you're like helping them understand what's going to happen next, and then when you see their energy data, you realize that it's not actually behavior. It's often unchosen. It's not lifestyle choices. It's unchosen things about your life, like your life stage.
Yeah.
Right? That's critical. Your health status. Well, that's not, my life stage. Maybe there's an element of choice in there, but it's also like,
I'm choosing not to go to Dignitas. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. My health status, my age, my gender, my work schedule,
and my access to outdoor space for drying my washing. That's the big fucker, isn't it?
Yeah, if the street's polluted as well, your household composition. Okay, some people might say that's choice. I don't call that a choice. It's an unchosen thing. And whether you have gas or electric heating, well, you don't have a choice about that in a lot of situations, especially if you're a tenant. And also whether your tenure and your sense of what you're able to do with where you live makes you feel like you can intervene, even with your thermostat. I always give this example, but we monitored two side-by-side houses, quite elderly people, one man alone, the other a couple. Everyone who's gone into homes, you could see the difference in being on it just by being in the house. The bills for the isolated person were three times as high. And it wasn't the fabric. It was having someone who could come and like sort stuff out and help. And that is, it's not profligacy, which is like if you're used to looking at models, and you've set you've got a set point in your model, that becomes like that's not a set point, it's a behavior. And if you're under your something, and if you're over, you're definitely greedy, and that's
dangerous. yeah I'd like to talk about this offline, I think, or not offline, off the recording at some point, because like there were two things you mentioned which we are not going to get into today, because I think we're out of time. But you mentioned your reluctance to use the words behavior and health, comfort and health in analyzing behavior, because they are so flexible or nebulous, or I mean.
Yeah, I did think about this a lot, because I listened to the interview with Utopia and Falk Blail. What's so interesting about that is I felt like his use of behavior was legit, because actually he's talking about a homogeneous group in terms of life stage. And actually that is sort of the correct use. But these questions, it comes exactly back to this question that I was exposed to in Haiti about what is the safety level?
Yeah.
Because actually the model of health is like a dose exposure model, which where you can measure the dose, like you measure the exposure. That's the easy part. The rest is like what is happening in the body. That's very poorly understood. And then what does that mean? What are the implications at a public health disease burden level? And then between those bits of information, we're going to set some thresholds. And those are the set points. And all of that middle stuff is actually really poorly understood. We don't have lots of monitored homes. We definitely don't have lots of monitored homes that are different, that are heterogeneous.
I tell you, Kate, there's a project here. I don't know if this is for using now in the podcast or not. But one of my neighbors in this, I rent an apartment in this kind of build-to-rent scheme, low-energy build-to-rent scheme. And one of my neighbors, a couple of apartment buildings down, is Oisin Smith. Oisin is he's a government minister. He's a Green Party minister, and he's the Minister of State, Minister for Public Expenditure. He's the first coder ever to be a government minister in Ireland, right? And he's a good guy. But before he got his job in the government, he was a coder and a database designer manager at St. Vincent's University Hospital, which is one of the main hospitals in Dublin. And he had this brilliant little thing that he implemented when people came into A&E in St. Vincent's to register. He would take their air code, which is our postcode system, the conditions that they're reporting, see if you could map out to find clustering of particular kinds of conditions. In other words, if there were environmental causes that were potentially, you know, now. I keep on telling him that this is the kind of stuff that some of these kind of wonkish greens do that's brilliant. I don't know why it hasn't happened since, because he doesn't have the health brief or whatever in government, why that isn't happening at a government level. But that kind of thinking, you know, because in Ireland, the postcodes here are now included in the building energy ratings, our versions of EPCs. So you could start to connect so many dots, you know, and come up with amazing evidence, you know. Anyway, there you go.
Right. I think there's an awful lot more to talk about. I think we will. We'll just have to find a time to do so.
We'll have to have you back on as well, because, you're a great guest, you know. I enjoy it by myself. And I normally find this painful.
I was so scared.
Oh, man. Is there anything that you've not had a chance to talk about that you wanted to?
No.
Cool. All right. Well, man, that was really interesting. Even the long explanation of what the thing is and how it works, it's hard to follow for me anyway. I don't know about Jeff, but it's a tough thing to explain, like 6 years of work.
I know. It's not my life's work.
See the pain on your face, like trying to work out, like, oh, Jesus, I better be doing myself justice here.
Public are unmoved. The researchers doing coheating tests are just like, unmoved. Like, come on, this is amazing.
Yeah. Who owns this ultimately, this product?
Oh, well, Smeeters, because of the way it was funded as a competition, are partially owned by government now. But because Knauf already built this technology, Knauf owns Knauf's build test solution is got build test solutions. So yeah, it depends. Like, these will come, right? And with smart meters everywhere, energy companies will have one. They'll make one.
Yeah, yeah.
They should be trying to claim credit for this as well, you know.
He's amazing.
Oh, wonderful. Well, thank you so much for joining us today. That's been really good fun.
Thank you for having me. I got so much off my chest. Oh, and I didn't have, like, the shame of nerdy excitement. Yeah.
You're not the first person to have described it as being like therapy. Or in those sorts of terms. All right, then. Right, I'll wrap up. So, join ACAN, join the ACB, join the IGBC. Women, check her own space. You will find all of these in the show notes. Subscribe to Passive House Plus magazine. It's not just about Passive House. Advertise in it as well. If you've got a business that needs to advertise, it is a magnificent vehicle for doing so. Talk to us about your projects. I mean, even if you just want to talk, like with the UX business that folk who follow us on LinkedIn may have seen, we do clinics with people where if they are facing a problem or a challenge, we'll give you an hour. We have a limited number that we do a week. So holler if you have a thing you want to talk about. We'll throw ideas at you and then work out what to do next. And there's no obligation, obviously. It's free of charge. What else? Share it, please, with friends and colleagues, just as Kate does with hers, and rate it as well. Review it if you can be bothered, and if you can't, that is also fine. Thank you for listening. Anything else, Jeff?
No. Thanks very much, Kate. That was really brilliant, though.
Yeah. Have you got anything to plug, Kate?
KLH Sustainability.
Excellent. They're on. The website will be there in the show notes. All right. Well, yeah, cheers. Thank you. And thank you for joining us at home. All right. Big up. Bye.
Bye.
Bye.